This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. The ACLU has filed a Freedom of Information Act request to the Customs and Border Patrol Agency to determine if their staff is continuing to enforce Donald Trump's Muslim ban at those airports where U.S. customs are handled before passengers take off, such as at Canadian ports. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals last week unanimously struck down the executive order that Trump signed, prohibiting nationals from seven Muslim-majority countries to enter the U.S. despite having valid visas or a refugee status. Mr. Trump on Twitter threatened to see the judges in court. Will the Muslim ban be found unconstitutional or not? After all, the U.S. has, throughout its history, carried out policies discriminating against specific ethnicities or groups of immigrants. My guest is Corey Brettschneider. He is a professor of political science at Brown University and the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality and Trump versus the Constitution. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So first, let's talk about how exactly these judges ruled so we can get an insight into what we might expect if and when their ruling is appealed to the Supreme Court. Did they specifically cite the unconstitutionality of the executive order?
Yes, they gave several. They didn't rule conclusively, but they found that there was a substantial likelihood that there was a violation, first of all, of the Due Process Clause. And then they also cited, again, without giving a conclusion, but their worries about the issues in regard to free exercise and relatedly to equal protection and also to the clause, part of the First Amendment banning an establishment of religion. So all of those added up to the conclusion that there was enough of a likelihood that in court the ban would be found unconstitutional that they put a stop to it, at least for now.
And they were essentially ruling on the case that a federal judge in Seattle, Judge Robart, had ruled on, and his decision had been appealed. So we've seen this executive order, lawsuits against this executive order, very rapidly climb the judicial branch. What's next? Has the Trump administration filed an appeal yet?
They haven't made it clear whether or not they're going to appeal to the Supreme Court, and I've heard different things over the last few days. I think it's just unclear. One thing they must be thinking is that the legal arguments that they're facing are very serious and substantial. There's a lot of evidence that this ban was based in unconstitutional animus based on religion and thus violated the Equal Protection Clause and Free Exercise Clause. Part of that is about Giuliani's statements. It's also about Trump's statements himself. And then written into the ban at the end was a preference for Christian refugees over Muslim refugees. They didn't use those terms, but what they said is minorities from these seven countries. And in those instances, they were all Muslim majority countries. So that is a very serious concern from the perspective of our limit on government establishing a religion. So, you know, I think they must see that they are up against some very serious constitutional claims.
So at this point, if it does get, if on the one hand they do appeal it to the Supreme Court, we have a court right now with one missing judge. Very likely it would be a 4-4 split with the four liberal judges affirming the Ninth Circuit Court's decision, the four conservative judges likely voting against it, or maybe they'll join with their liberal colleagues, who knows. But very unlikely that with the current current setup of the court, much would change. It would likely simply reaffirm the Ninth Circuit Court's decision. However, if Neil Gorsuch is indeed confirmed to the Supreme Court, by the time the appeal reaches it, we'll have a very different story.
Well, I actually don't share the view. I could see why many people would think that, but I think this isn't a liberal or conservative issue. The concerns about religious freedom really cut across the court in unusual ways about free exercise of religion and equal protection. And in my view, this is so blatantly a instance of animus based on religion and towards Islam that I think I would expect to see a stronger affirmation of the Ninth Circuit's decision than just an even liberal conservative split. It's religious freedom is not a typical issue, and many of Trump's statements and certainly this ban just cut against constitutional democracy more generally. So I think we're in an unusual situation. This isn't the normal partisan kind of politics that we're used to in this country.
Now, we have, as I mentioned, seen this country enact discriminatory policies against specific ethnicities, specific groups of immigrants. But do those offer precedents, given that usually there have been race or ethnicity or national origin based, and not necessarily religion?
Well, there is a case that's on point from the 19th century that's commonly referred to as the Chinese Exclusion Act case. And this is a famous case in which there was a resident of the United States who left to go to China and then tried to return. And in the interim period in which he was gone, Congress actually passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, stopping immigration from China. And he brought a constitutional claim and was denied. And the precedent that this established is known as the idea of the president having plenary power, absolute power over issues of immigration. So Trump has a case on his side. And as you said, there were ethnic quotas throughout American history, regarding race. But the question now is whether or not our law of equal protection and free exercise and establishment has evolved to the point where we just wouldn't find that case to come out in the same way. So just to make the point, the world in which that case was decided was the world in which Plessy versus Ferguson and separate but equal was also good law. And that's a precedent, of course, that was not only overturned, but overturned by what's now regarded as a super precedent, and that's Brown versus Board of Ed. So I don't see the court affirming this 19th century case with all the racism that's associated with it. I believe that they would see that the modern doctrine of equal protection and free exercise and establishment really pierces through the president's supposedly absolute power, even in matters of immigration.
Corey, do you think that Trump really knows the Constitution? Does he understand what this document is? I mean, his predecessor was a constitutional lawyer, went to Harvard. We had no doubt that Barack Obama, even in cases where he might have attempted to violate the Constitution, there's usually no doubt that he had read it and, you know, understood it as best as any expert can. I don't think we can say the same for Trump.
Well, over the summer during the campaign, I tried to make that argument in a piece for Politico called Trump versus the Constitution. And my point wasn't just that he's made many unconstitutional proposals, including at the time what was explicitly a Muslim ban, that he was going to have a complete shutdown of Muslim immigration to the United States, and his claims about torturing the families of suspected terrorists. Those are so blatantly unconstitutional. But it was that together, all of these specific proposals and his statements many times just added up to the idea that he didn't understand the basics of our constitutional system, that we don't elect a dictator in this country, that we elect a president who is limited by civil liberties and civil rights and by courts that will enforce them. And so, no, I don't think that he understands the basics of our system. And what you're seeing unfold isn't just a case about a ban targeting some Muslims. It's a case about a president receiving the most historic and widely publicized constitutional education in the nation's history.
So what do you think will happen to the Muslim ban? Will this die a legal death?
I think the Ninth Circuit did exactly the right thing. I think that they were right to raise these issues and that it clearly is a violation of these clauses, free exercise, equal protection. And if the president wants to try again at the Supreme Court, I think that they'll be affirmed by conservative and by liberal justices. Now, maybe that would be a good thing because it would be a clear message that was sent by the judiciary to President Trump. Unfortunately, as you reported earlier, he seems sometimes to be doubling down, to be questioning the court's authority and the phrase like so-called judges. And what's very troubling about that is that's not just a challenge to one decision. It seems sometimes to be challenging the judiciary itself. And that risks a more serious crisis. You saw that also during the campaign with his attacks on a judge who was he challenged because of his heritage. And all of that amounts to even more serious, in my views, concerns.
And we know that his own nominee for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, has expressed how troubled he is by these attacks on judges. He, I believe, used the word demoralizing. Trump tried to brush that aside, but Gorsuch's staff apparently confirmed that this is what the judicial nominee had expressed. It's just kind of, we live in strange times indeed. Let's talk about what the recourse is for ordinary people against a president who seems to have so little understanding of the Constitution and so little regard for it. We've seen reports that he needs to have things simplified for him. He gets bored easily. He signs things without reading them properly. Things happen that he approved of but wasn't aware of the details of what he was approving of. How do we protect ourselves from this kind of out of control, maniacal presence in the White House, particularly, I mean, even if we live in states like California, say, California has decided that it will protect its undocumented immigrants as much as it possibly can. However, federal agents can still come and round people up, as they have done, and deport them.
Yeah, I mean, one recourse, of course, is courts. And in this country, thankfully, we have a constitution and we have statutory protections and individuals can go there. And they have the ability, as has happened here, to rule that executive orders or acts by the president violate the United States Constitution. Another recourse, I think, is going to be found in what was traditionally seen as a conservative doctrine of federalism and the idea that the federal government's power in this country is not unlimited. It's a government that's granted specific powers, but there are also limits to what the federal government can do. So, for instance, in the California case, if the federal government tried to take over a state agency and force it to cooperate with the federal government in deportation, the states would be well within their 10th Amendment rights to resist such an attempt at commandeering. The same with the spending clause. He's threatening to revoke all of the funding of sanctuary cities. There are precedents that suggest that although grants can be conditioned specifically related to the purpose of the grants by the federal government, that using the spending clause and spending as a bludgeon to be forced upon the states or localities is not consistent with our constitutional system. Now, that's usually a conservative doctrine, but I think especially when basic rights are concerned, that's the place for the states to step up and to fight back. And I'll note, too, that in this case that we've been discussing at length, it is the attorney generals of Washington and Minnesota that brought the case and fought back. And so I think that's the power of the states is particularly important at this point in history.
So, yes, states' rights are usually cited often by Republicans, except when it comes to having a Republican in power that can push the Republican agenda from the federal level. Now, speaking of Trump's inability to understand or desire to not even understand the Constitution, it doesn't seem as though too many, you know, some people on his cabinet understand it either. One of his top advisors, Stephen Miller, made an extraordinary statement about executive power to the press. He said, "Our opponents, the media, and the whole world will soon see as we begin to take further actions that the powers of the president to protect our country are very substantial and will not be questioned." That last phrase in particular, will not be questioned. When people say that we're watching a potential slide into fascism, when you hear statements like this, it does not sound like hyperbole.
Well, I mean, the first part is true. There are substantial powers of the president in areas of national security. The second part that I don't know what this idea is that the president won't be challenged. We have a First Amendment that protects not only religious freedom, as we've discussed, but certainly free speech. And certainly the freedom of the press to criticize the president. We did have in the 18th century, at the beginning of the Republic, acts passed by Congress limiting criticism of the president of the United States, John Adams, allowing it for criticism of the vice president, Jefferson, a member of a different party at the time. But those acts are seen as embarrassment in our country's history and an obvious violation of the First Amendment free speech protection. Incidentally, Madison and Jefferson themselves went to Virginia and Kentucky and used the state legislatures to pass resolutions declaring those acts unconstitutional. And we need to hear it from all sides that it is absolutely a right of every American and every government official to criticize the President of the United States. It's actually a duty, I think, not just a right demanded by our Constitution.
Finally, one of the other very strong themes of the early days of Trump's presidency are his attacks on the media. The press and the freedom of the press is another absolutely crucial tenet of American democracy. And Trump has declared war. Trump and his cabinet have declared war on the media. I mean, they've been very open about it. It's been lampooned on Saturday Night Live. How much of a threat to press freedom does Trump represent?
Well, I think it goes back to your question about the degree to which he's internalized the ideas of the American Constitution. Our First Amendment protections of free speech are central for the press, not just because it's important for people to be able to express themselves, but because what democracy depends on is a free press in which, as a citizen, everyone is able to hear the information, the criticisms, to deliberate, to think about what policies should be, and then to make a free decision. And if there are threats to the press or threats to that process, that's not just a threat to the First Amendment or to free speech or to the Constitution. That's a threat to the very idea of democracy. So it's essential that all of us be vigilant and continuing to look at these issues, to speak out against attacks on our system of constitutional democracy.
It's going to be an interesting ride indeed, Corey. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Where's the best place people can read your writings?
They can find me on Twitter at BrettschneiderC. I have a collection of my writings at CoreyBrettschneider.com, and I write frequently for Politico, and I have a piece in Time magazine as well that they might take a look at.
Thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My guest is Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.